Maybe they'll just listen to us talk.
Or as it gets later and later, I might just get a little more ridiculous and silly because I don't handle myself well when it gets late into the night. I just get a little like, bleh.
Who knows? And it is late because we are already like, we had to record an episode twice and now we're recording this one. So it's a long night and it's a weekday. So we still have work.
Don't talk about work. Gross. Okay.
Oh, shoot. Hold on. My fan is still on. I was wondering why it was picking up so much sound.
Didn't you do that in 2 weeks ago's episode already?
Oh, no. But you couldn't hear it because it was picking up the wrong mic quality.
Oh, that's right. So good.
So give it a second for my fan to slow down, guys. Do, 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 do. Sweet home Alabama. Yeah, the skies are so blue. All right. Well, yeah, so sorry for the very loud introduction because my fan was still on because it's triple digits and I'm dying because we've already recorded a bunch of times, so.
Yep, so whatever. Well, we're gonna live with how it is, however it is this week. We are fine with it. Give us a little grace, a little leeway, a little acceptance, a little love.
Yeah, there we go. And that's how you can tell it's getting real late, because Amber turned into a hippie right there. Little grace, little peace, little love. That's like the opening to like a 70s cult, like welcoming everybody in. Welcome to the SOM cult, everybody. We are in this part of the evening.
I'm going to burn a little, what do you call that? I was going to say essence.
Sage?
No, what do you call those sticks that smell like patchouli? What do you call those? Those little sticks that look like...
Incense?
Incense! I was going to call them the essences. Essences of smells! That, I told you, it starts getting late. I'm starting to overheat. I've started sweating. Like, who knows what this episode's going to bring?
Welcome, everybody, to State of Murder, and we have made it to the great state of Alabama, which has a song after it.
Sweet home Alabama. Do, do, do. Did you know that Alabama, this could, I guess, have been our fun fact, but I read that they paid, what, $75,000 to be able to use Sweet Home Alabama as their slogan for 5 years.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was $75,000 is what I read.
For only 5 years?
Yeah.
That's it? They don't get to do it forever?
No.
Oh, God.
So, that could have been a super fun state fact, but we're doing other ones. We have other funny things.
Yeah, I feel like we have better fun facts for Alabama than that.
But that's, I did read that, so.
Okay. Well, since we are in Alabama, sorry that we aren't talking too much. We are recording multiple episodes at the same time tonight, one of which we've had to record twice already. So we're all out of funniness for the beginning of this episode. Shit. I'm sure we'll find something.
Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah, and Alabama, I think, is a good state to get a little weird on. So
it is. It is a little
let's
weird.
Let's jump right in. What case do you got for us this week?
All right. So this week I'm going to be telling you guys about the murder of Stephanie Shay Graham. She doesn't go by Stephanie. She goes by Shay. So that's what I'm going to be calling her. So to tell Shay's story, you have to start with the story of her parents. So Shay's parents were Lisa and Kevin Graham. Now, Lisa and Kevin actually grew up together. They met when they lived near each other, so they were neighbors. Kevin was 11 and Lisa was 9. So they became very close friends. They played together and just kind of grew up together. They would go to the movies and just hang out. When Lisa was 15, she ended up asking Kevin if they were gonna go out or not. So she kind of got up the nerve. She was driving by his house, I'm guessing on her bicycle. And just like he said, she went by his house like 10 times and then finally came up to him. He was cleaning his car. And that's what she said. Are we going out or not? So
nice. Hey, get what you want, girl.
Hey, yeah. So they started to date. So pretty much they were childhood sweethearts. When Kevin graduated high school, he ended up taking a job at a local factory and just started to work. Once Lisa graduated high school, they ended up moving in together, and quickly after that, they got married. So, Kevin, I guess they were just sitting around one day, and Kevin was like, I think we should get married. And so, they went to the courthouse and did just that. Just like, boom, done. They ended up going back home and eating ham sandwiches. So, you know, easy peasy. Not long after they got married, Lisa became pregnant, and they had their daughter, Shay. Kevin was super excited about becoming a dad. However, he was worried that his factory job wouldn't be enough to support his growing family. So he ended up taking the contractor's license test, and he passed, and he actually ended up opening his own construction company. So Lisa stayed home with their daughter, and she actually ended up running the office and business side of their construction company. And just like any family business would be, when it was getting off the ground, there was a lot of financial struggles at the beginning. However, the company was able to grow, and it actually became pretty successful. So when they first started, like, they were building like just like one or two houses a month. And at the height, they were building like one house a week. So they grew pretty good.
Yeah.
So while their business was growing, so did Shay. Her family described her as so very adventuresome, and I hate when people say this because I just don't like when people describe girls as tomboys because they like some kind of what is deemed manly activities, boyish activities, but Shay loved anything to do with cars and racing. So it started when her dad bought her first go-kart when she was 3 years old. And so, nice. I know, so she would just drive it around, have a good time. She actually started, I think they're called stock cars, but like car racing when she was 14. She would race the dirt track at the East Alabama Speedway. And she was apparently, by all accounts, pretty good. When Shay was 13, her little brother, Kevin Jr., was born. Just side note. So they had two kids. People around town and her family describe Shay as a little bit on the wild side. A police detective actually shared that he remembered, like, he would always have to pull Shay over when she was younger because she would be driving her four-wheeler on the street, which is against the law. So he pulled her over numerous times for doing that. Her aunt stated that Shay was no angel. In an interview her father gave, Kevin shared that once Shay was starting to race, so like about when she was 13 or 14, she started hanging out with what they deemed the wrong crowd, so kind of like bad seeds, and that's when she started doing drugs. So she actually ended up getting arrested and placed in juvie, and when she got in front of the judge, she actually had to go in front of the judge twice a week kind of to explain what she was doing, kind of as a check system. So which I don't think is a bad thing necessarily. So during that time, she started kind of straightening up. So she was able to graduate high school and enrolled in college. Many people said she was really trying to turn her life around. However, Shay ended up dropping out of college after one semester of school and then started hanging out with that bad crowd again. This was like when she was 19. So Shay started apparently working at a local gentleman's club. So she was stripping, which totally upset her mother, Lisa. Lisa did not agree with her decisions and the direction that her daughter's life was going. So then in September of 2006, Shay was arrested again. This time, not for drugs, but because she was involved with a drive-by shooting. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So she wasn't the one shooting the gun. She was actually the one driving the car. Luckily, nobody was seriously injured, and pretty much there was just a lot of property damage. However, Shay was arrested, and she needed to be bailed out of jail. So her dad ended up getting $100,000 in cash, which I was like, holy fucking shit. Do you just go to the bank and are like, can I get $100,000 in cash? What?
I mean, I think usually there has to be some type of like time delay on
I have no
it
idea.
because, like, I don't think the bank will just give you that kind of cash. I don't know, maybe.
I don't have
I don't know.
$100,000, but
I should do that. Next time we go to the bank, I'll be like, question, if I had $100,000 and I wanted it all in cash right now, I'm not robbing you, don't worry. But
Would you be
would
able
you
to?
give it to me? Or would I have to go through a waiting period?
So I don't know. I
That's
mean,
how
this,
Selena gets arrested.
yeah, this wasn't that long ago. So this was in 2006, or yeah,
Before the banks had to be bailed out. So maybe they did have that kind of money.
maybe they
It's
did. Who knew?
before a recession.
Yeah. So apparently, this was quite a big chunk of their kind of retirement nest egg, which I would imagine.
Yeah.
So Kevin kept talking about how they had planned, he and his wife Lisa had planned to like retire by the time they were 50. And I was like, if $100,000 is a big chunk of your retirement, I don't think you're gonna retire at 50. But whatever.
Yeah.
Not saying. So he ended up getting that $100,000 and bailing her out. So it would take almost a year for the court date to be set. So it was set for July 6, 2007. During that year, so remember the incident happened in September of 2006. So during that year waiting time, Shay lived with her parents. She would hang out with her friends and apparently argue a lot with her mom, which I mean,
Yeah.
what like 19, 20-year-old girl like isn't arguing with their mom, isn't kind of partying, getting a little crazy. It's kind of that time in your life that you do that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't become a stripper when I was in high school, so that's a little much, but I mean, I see your point. Like,
Yeah.
generally, like, the arguing with parents comes with the
Not, I'm not
teenage
saying,
territory.
I'm not saying stripping, okay, if that's your calling and that's what you want to do, okay, yeah, but yes, that's not something I
Yeah.
did.
But,
But,
like, if drugs are involved and there sounds like a whole lot of other shady
yeah.
stuff, I say no. But if you want to strip, you do
Yeah.
your thing, girl.
Yeah, the
You make that
drive-bys,
money.
there's some decision making that obviously wasn't great with Shay. And I got a lot of my information from court cases and then a number of news articles, but then there was also, this was an episode of Snapped, which I'd never watched Snapped before. So this is the first episode I've ever seen. There were a couple discrepancies between what Snap reported and what the court papers said. So there was a little bit of differences, but you got a lot of like the family side in that because a lot of the family was interviewed and a lot of the detectives were interviewed for Snapped. So according to a number of family members and Kevin, when Lisa and her mom would argue, Kevin would always take his daughter's side and not take the mom's side, which kind of upset Lisa. So I don't, yeah, and I don't know if it was he was accepting that way she was behaving and Lisa was the only one speaking out about that she was kind of getting a little bit wild and not making the best decisions, but
Yeah.
Lisa wanted more support. So on July 6, 2007, when Kevin got up from to go to work, he noticed that Shay wasn't home and her truck was missing. Becoming concerned for their daughter, Lisa and Kevin started to frantically look for her all about town. By that evening, when they couldn't find her, Lisa called the police and reported Shay missing. When the police received that call, they had some answers. You see, before midnight on July 5th, a truck driver was driving down Highway 165 when he spotted what he thought was a deer on the side of the road. Of course, you guys are listening to a murder podcast, so you know it wasn't a deer on the side of the road. It was.
Never a
It,
deer
no.
or a random object or an
Nope.
animal or a mannequin.
Nope.
Nope.
So it was actually a young woman laying on the road with her pants around her ankles, and she had been shot. The truck driver called it in to the sheriff's department, and they came out to investigate. When they started their investigation, they had a Jane Doe, as the young woman had no identification on her. She had been shot multiple times at close range. One shot entering her right eye, another to the back of the right side of her head. She was then shot once in the chest and twice in the stomach. Of course, the shots to the head were fatal. The police observed that her pants were down around her ankles, so they assumed she had been sexually assaulted. However, when the body was brought into the medical examiner, there were actually no signs of sexual assault, which is
Wow.
kind of weird because all of her pants, everything was pulled down.
Yeah,
So
but also, like, I guess silver lining, like, at least she didn't have to go through being assaulted on top of that.
yeah, very true. So the first priority for the sheriff's department was identifying this young woman. It didn't take long because the next day, Lisa Graham called in about her missing daughter. The sheriffs compared Shay's fingerprints that were on record and quickly came up with the match. They identified Shay's body. The sheriffs ended up bringing Lisa and Kevin into the sheriff's office and shared that Shay had been murdered on the road. Kevin and Lisa were distraught. Kevin shared that Lisa was completely inconsolable. She was almost in hysterics, which honestly, I think almost any parent would be getting the news that their child had died. Not even just murder. Like if your child just dies, that's horrible. So now the police had to figure out who could have murdered Shay. One question was why Shay's pants were down if she hadn't been assaulted. Mm-hmm. So they questioned, was it set up to look like an assault? Or did maybe the person that was assaulting her just not have the opportunity because something else happened? All the police knew was that the gun used was a 9mm gun. Then, of course, Shay's past comes into question. Her court date was actually supposed to be July 6th, which is the day that her body was found. So did her murder have something to do with that drive-by shooting, or was it drug-related? Of course, the police started looking into where Shay had been on July 5th. It was pretty easy to track this down, as Shay had spent time with her friends that night. So she was hanging out with them around 10 p.m. They had been hanging out when Shay apparently got a phone call, and she stated to them that she had to meet up with someone and take care of some business. So her friends dropped her off at the Raceway gas station, and there they saw her getting picked up by a truck. So most didn't really have any idea. Okay,
they saw her getting picked up by a truck, and they didn't do anything?
Well, no, because she was supposed to meet this guy. She was supposed to. Oh, so okay. So they knew she was being picked up by a guy with a truck. Now, most of her friends didn't know who it was, but one of her friends was able to identify the driver as Kenneth Walton, known as Kenny. Kenny was really close with the Graham family as he had worked for Shay's dad in the construction business doing odd jobs. So typically he would, after they had finished building the houses, he would clean up all of the house so that it was ready for the owners. However, he had been fired earlier that week because he apparently had totaled a dump truck in their yard. So the dad was like, no.
How do you total a dump truck?
I know. You totally totaled it. I have no idea. They didn't give any more specifics than that. But when Kevin fired him, apparently they'd gotten into a huge argument. So the firing did not go down well. And Kenny had worked for them for a really long time, like years and years and years.
Okay.
So could that have been the motive? Kenny was also known around town as an enforcer for drug dealers and had also been arrested numerous times. So the police needed to prove that Kenny was the one that, in fact, did pick up Shay. So they headed to the gas station and found surveillance video of Kenny there and Shay getting into his truck. So they had enough to bring Kenny in.
Mm-hmm.
So what Kenny would share with them, however, was not at all what they were prepared for. You see, Kenny did admit to the murder. He stated that he picked her up and that the reason he was picking her up was that she had called him that week and asked him to get her a car because she wanted to skip town and skip out on bail.
Okay.
So he called her that on July 5th and stated that he had a car for her. He picked her up, drove her out on Highway 165, and pulled over because Shay needed to use the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So she got out of his truck, squatted down, and started to pee. And he ended up leaning over the window, leaning out the passenger side, and shot her the first time.
What the fuck?
Mm-hmm. Then he got out of his truck, walked around, and shot her like four or five more times. So, and then also in Snapped, I didn't see this in the police article, so I don't know if it's true or not, but apparently in Snapped, well, and the detectives mentioned it in Snapped, is that he also, when he took off, he ended up running her over. So,
oh my God.
So there were tire tracks on her.
Jesus.
Yeah. So the police wanted to know why he all of a sudden, if he was just getting, you know, was telling that he got a car for her, why did it like end up in murder? So Kenny shared that it was because Mrs. Graham had hired him to kill her daughter.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So he reported on July 5th, Kenny had met up with Lisa at the local library And he shared that Shay had had plans to skip out on her bail, thus meaning that Lisa and Kevin would lose out on that $100,000 bond that they did. They wouldn't get that back. So if she skipped out, that money was gone.
Yeah.
So Lisa became... But, oh, go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry. Like, I understand that. But why wouldn't you just hire this guy to bring her back home mm-hmm. and you fucking chain her ass to the bed or something? Or... take her to jail and say, just kidding, you yeah. can have her.
Yeah.
Give us our money back.
Yeah, exactly.
Changed our mind. There's so many other plausible things other than murder.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. So during their conversation, apparently Kenny says that she pretty much was like, we need to get rid of her. Like, it just needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Because she didn't know what else to do with Shay. Like, she was at her wit's end. Like, all of the shit Shay has been putting her through, the $100,000. So, yeah. She asked Kenny to get rid of her. Lisa even provided him with the 9mm gun that she always carried in her car. Now, Kenny stated that they hadn't actually spoken about a specific price, but Lisa did say that Kenny just needed to call her and she would give him whatever he asked for. So... Kenny shared that after he murdered Shay, he ended up returning the gun to Lisa right after the murder. So she now had the murder weapon. So the sheriff's department had Kenny actually call Lisa and talk to her about the murder. So in Snapped, you can see him talking, but you can't hear Lisa's response. But apparently, mm-hmm. like, her reactions to him saying, you know, that Shay thing you had me do, can you help me? I got picked up by the police. I need a lawyer. Can you hire me a lawyer? And then I guess whatever her responses were was enough for the sheriff's department to get a warrant. So they got a warrant to look through Lisa's house and do a search. So when they got to Kevin and Lisa's house, the first thing they asked about was Lisa's gun. She stated that she didn't know where it was, but Kevin stated that it was probably over at their neighbor Papa's house to get cleaned. So,
what an Alabama neighbor's name.
I know. So, the police ended up going and knocking on Papa's door and asking him if he had Lisa's gun. And he stated, yes, in fact, I do. She brought it over today to get cleaned. And he hadn't had an opportunity to clean it.
Wow.
So the sheriff's picked up the gun and they found human body matter on it. So this was enough to arrest Lisa. So when she was interrogated by the police, she stated that it was just all a misunderstanding and that she had in fact talked to Kenny, but that she didn't really mean for him to kill Shay. That she said it out of anger and she didn't know what else to do. So she said that she didn't specifically ask him to kill Shay, and that it was more Kenny's idea. And he was like, no, the best thing to do is get rid of her. And she didn't say yes or no.
Wow.
Yeah. So when her case was finally heard, another neighbor, this was in Snapped and he was interviewed. And so he testified that previously, according to him, I guess Shay was outside on his lawn attacked like one night with a knife trying to stab her boyfriend. And so he went and knocked on Lisa and Kevin's door. And Kevin was just like, oh, shit. And so he went to go take care of Shay and, like, stop the altercation. And while the neighbor was at the door, Lisa apparently offered him $5,000 to kill Shay at that time. But he thought she was totally joking until he stated that after her murder, he obviously knew that it wasn't a joke. And then Kevin's sister was also interviewed, and she talked about how anytime Lisa would get mad, she'd get like super red in the face, and she would always talk about how she wanted Shay murdered. And like, it was it was just a common thing. Like, whenever she would get mad, like, that was her go-to.
Jesus.
And so I guess nobody took her that seriously. So...
After, like, threat number two, I feel like I would start to take this woman a little seriously.
Yeah. Kenny ended up taking a plea deal of life in prison instead of the death penalty as he agreed to testify against Lisa Graham. So if he testified, he wouldn't be, they wouldn't put the death penalty on the table for him. Mm-hmm. So he did that. Lisa's case, however, wasn't so easy. There was so much, like, it took 8 years for her case to get heard.
Damn.
The first 2 years, because apparently they weren't having court cases heard in there. This is in Phoenix City because mm-hmm. the courthouse was being remodeled. So I don't know if no cases were heard in 2.5 years.
Jesus.
But then after that, her case started to get heard, but the judge presiding halfway through it, the trial, had to recuse himself and declare a mistrial because he was getting so physically sick. He actually ended up passing away a month after that, something to do with his diabetes. So it was a mistrial. Then her attorneys appealed that because they were going to try her again. And so they were trying to say, well, she has already been tried for this case by that judge and he could continue. And it was just bullshit that he didn't. And so So they were trying to say if she got tried again, it would be double jeopardy. And then, like, the Alabama Supreme Court was like, no, that's bullshit. She was not innocent. Like, there was no ruling. Like, this judge
died. We Googled it. You could have as many mistrials and retrials as possible. Yeah,
exactly. So it took 8 years for her case to be heard. And then the other thing that her attorneys tried to get her off on was the fact that no money had been exchanged. So really, it wasn't a murder for hire because she didn't actually hire him to do it. And so that was kind of the defense, is that it was a misunderstanding. She didn't actually hire him. It was like the heat of the moment. She just didn't know what else to do. And then he took her seriously. So it really wasn't her fault.
Just because someone hasn't had the opportunity to pay you yet because your ass got arrested doesn't yeah. mean that they weren't going to pay you.
Yeah.
Like, you obviously, you do all the work for your job before they give you your paycheck. That doesn't mean that they didn't hire you to do the job. Like, yeah. it's stupid.
Exactly. So once her case was heard, the jury found her guilty of murder, and Lisa Graham was given the death penalty.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So she currently is on death row in Alabama. Her last appeal was denied in 2019. Her husband, Kevin, divorced her, obviously. And then her side of the family doesn't think that she deserves this. And her son is a big proponent. So he was interviewed for Snapped and he actually went in front of the judge and asked for leniency. But the judge was like, no, and chose the death penalty. So her son's really upset about it. But it was found that she was guilty of murder because she yeah. hired Kenny to kill her daughter. And this town, it's not that big. It's like 30,000 people. So this town was shook by this. This was like the news of the century for this town because nobody expected that the mom was the instigator for this murder.
That's like crazy. At first I was like, what a weird story for him to be like, the mom hired me. But then I was like, oh shit. No yeah. wonder they call it Snapped. Jesus yeah. Christ.
I know. Like, so that is the story of Shay Graham and her awful mother. Like, I don't care if you're not meeting your parents' expectations, and like $100,000 is not worth the life of your child. You know, it's like it's $100,000.
Take that up with your husband, like, who gave her the money. Like, why is that?
Plus the fact that her family, not the husband didn't do it, but her family, because like the trial took so freaking long, they ended up bailing her out for $250,000. So they paid a $250,000 bond to get her out for 2 years while they waited for her trial to happen. And I'm like, and wow. you killed your daughter over $100,000? Like, shit.
Damn. So. Well, thank you for sharing.
Yeah. So what's your story this week?
So my story's a little different this week. Technically, murders still happen. I just don't think it's like a direct thing. Mine's a little bit more of like a historical type thing. I don't okay. know. I'll get into it. So it's not the typical true crime that we usually cover, but this is definitely a crime. So This is about the Tuskegee experiment, which you had told me when I told you this was my case. You had never heard of that before, right?
No, I've heard of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah, me too. But this is not that.
Okay.
So in the early 1900s, for whatever reason, there was a growing fascination with the disease syphilis. Don't ask me why. Maybe there was curiosity about a lot of different diseases, but this seemed to be coming up in studies a lot.
Okay.
In 1928, scientists in Oslo, Norway, began to study the effects of untreated syphilis on hundreds of white males, because that's who lives in Norway.
Yeah. And, so, and it makes you go mad, right?
Yeah. So okay. We'll talk about this, the complications of syphilis that happen, or okay. The symptoms of it if it goes untreated. But this study was a retrospective study. For anyone who doesn't know, a retrospective study means that you basically, like, have this disease is ongoing, it's affecting people, you pose a question and you look back. So they basically were like, oh, all these people have syphilis, let's look at their medical history and see what happened because they hadn't got it treated.
Yeah.
When the U.S. Public Health Service, who I'm going to be shortening a lot because they come up a lot, to either the USPHS or just the PHS, just to let you guys know.
Okay.
So when they heard about this, they wanted to build on the work done by those in Oslo and study the effects in a prospective study. So the prospective study is slightly different. Shit. I know. So the prospective study, for anyone who doesn't know, means that they're testing a hypothesis over a period of time. So basically, like, the investigators come in at a different point. They don't come in after the fact. They come in kind of in the middle, study this stuff, and, like, pose a hypothesis and then see it out to the end. And
this is what happens when syphilis goes untreated.
Basically, they had a slightly different question than that. But it was a similar thing. They were basically testing that. So they believed that the pathology associated, which is basically like the symptoms that are associated with the disease, would vary depending on the race of an individual.
Oh,
which,
fuck.
I know, you can already see where this is going.
Yep. Okay. Alabama. So, we're in Alabama.
Yeah. Yeah, we are.
Okay.
So Talia Farrow Clark, which, oh my God, that's a first name. He was the head of the USPHS at the time. And he decided to create a study to determine if there really were those differences between the different races. And there was this quote of his that I thought was really relevant to how he kind of chose the location of this, because they randomly just picked this county.
Okay.
And so this is a quote that he had mentioned. He said, "The rather low intelligence of the Negro population..." Ugh. I'm so irritated.
Fuck you.
I know. "Depressed economic conditions and the common promiscuous sex relations not only contribute to the spread of syphilis, but the prevailing indifference with regards to treatment." So he's basically saying that not only do African Americans have low intelligence, they live in bad economic conditions, they're promiscuous, but they don't really care about seeking treatment, so they should be the group that we're studying, which every single thing is wrong about what he said.
Yeah.
And also, like, with the exception of economics, if you don't have a lot of access to healthcare because of your economic situation, totally get that.
Yeah.
That could definitely lead to that. Everything else is totally wrong and super racist and terrible. Yeah. So they chose Macon County in Alabama, which houses Tuskegee.
Mm-hmm.
And just like we suspected, it has a mostly African-American community.
Yeah.
But not only does it have a large African-American community, but the families here are generally poor. And since it's a rural community, medical treatment is generally reserved for emergency situations. So this made the residents easy targets for this study. In 1932, flyers popped up around the county promising colored people, which I fucking hate that word, but anyway, special treatment for what they called bad blood. And so bad blood is basically like, it's a catch-all for like diseases. They would just say you had bad blood when it was things like syphilis or anemia or fatigue or just random things that they didn't understand.
Yeah.
So the flyers that went up would read "free blood test, free treatment by county health department and government doctors. You may feel well and still have bad blood. Come and bring all your family. So, lots of things wrong with that. But also, like, nowadays, I feel like if I saw that it was government doctors, I'd be like, no, thank you. Like, I'm going the other way.
Yeah.
But back in the early, like, this was the 1930s. They were just saying, mm-hmm. like, oh, it's all free. They're going to take care of us. We don't have to use it for that emergency situation because we live in a lower income community. So the participants were offered free medical exams, free meals, and also burial insurance if anything happened, which I guess...
A pretty good deal, apparently.
Yeah. As soon as they were offering me burial insurance, I'd be like,
especially for the 1930s, because it's the Great Depression, like, shit isn't great.
Yeah. Altogether, they gathered 600 men for the study. 399 of them had syphilis, and 201 of them were not infected, so they were the control group.
Okay.
They were never told that they had syphilis. Instead, they were told that they were being treated for bad blood, so they never explicitly said what was going on. The goal of this study was to determine if there was a difference in the effects of syphilis, because it was believed that syphilis had more of an effect on African Americans' cardiovascular systems than on their central nervous system, because they believed that white people experienced more of, like, neurosyphilis, so the stuff that, like, affects your brain, those kind of conditions.
Yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know, if left untreated, syphilis can lead to blindness, deafness, mental illness, heart disease, bone deterioration, collapse of the central nervous system, and even death.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, like, when I heard of this, it actually reminded me, I think it was an episode of House that they did, where, like, there was this old lady, and I think it was an old lady or an old man, this old elderly person, they had syphilis, and they couldn't figure out why they were slowly, like, losing their mind, or, like, dementia or whatever. Yeah. They were going over all of these things, and there were other health problems going on, and finally they figured out that it was, like, she had syphilis. It was undiagnosed, and it was basically, like, from, like, way back when, and it was, like, eating her brain, basically, like, because that's what it does. So, not only were they studying the differences in race, but they were really trying to show that white people experience more of the neurological symptoms, and African-American people would experience more of the heart problems, cardiovascular issues.
Didn't just, because syphilis, we're talking syphilis, isn't it a theory that Beethoven... I think it is that Beethoven had syphilis, and that's why he lost his hearing, and that he possibly died from it. I think that's right.
I don't know. If you know whether that's right or not, send us a message. Let us know. So during these studies, even with all of those consequences, they continued to, like, reach out, try to gather support, and make this an ongoing thing. They even had the participants' families targeted into signing autopsy agreements in return for funeral benefits. They're like, hey, if anything does happen, we get to do the autopsy, but you still get some benefits from it. Which is just so fucked up.
Yeah, because...
so messed up. So, the study began, and over the next 6 months... blood was drawn from these men. They got kind of, like, check-ins occasionally. I even read in a few articles that they had done spinal taps on them, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is where they stick this gigantic needle into your spine, suck out spinal fluid to test it for things. So, like, basically, I think it's what, if they think you have, like, meningitis or whatever, they usually do a spinal tap. Did you know I got a spinal tap when I was a baby? Like, when I was born, I was just, like, a month old, 2 months old or something like that. And I got really, really sick. So, side note, story about me. I spiked a huge fever, I guess like a month or something after I was born. And my mom thinks I got sick in the doctor's office because they had taken me for whatever checkup that day. Yeah. And then that night I got like super sick. My mom used to work in a hospital. Like she was a lab tech before I was born. And so... immediately once my fever spiked, she started crying. They took me to the hospital. My dad had no idea why she was freaking out, but my mom knew exactly what they had to run through when babies spike a fever. They test for, like, meningitis. Yeah. So they're going to have to do a spinal tap. So my mom didn't tell my dad that's what they were going to do. My mom couldn't go in the room. My dad was like, fine, I'll be with her. And I don't know if he was in like an observation room or he just happened to be in the same room, whatever it was. But he said they curled me up in like a tiny little ball. So not only do I have a fever, but I'm freaking out because I'm being like crumpled up.
Yeah.
Like this little baby being crumpled up. And he goes, I got weak in the knees because they pushed a needle into your spine and you were so pissed. You were changing colors. But oh, like yeah, luckily sure. like, the fluid was clear. I was all good. I didn't have meningitis. But it was just like broke my mom. My dad was like,
yeah,
it was probably a good thing she didn't tell me because I couldn't have done it. But that was the story of them giving me a spinal tap before I could remember it. So yeah,
thank God before you could remember it.
Ugh. I know. So they totally did these things on these men, and they described them as special free treatments.
Yeah.
So that way they would go get everything was like a special treatment or free treatment or
it yeah,
free
it's like oh treatment. You're so lucky that you're getting to do this. Fuck you.
Mm-hmm. So symptoms were also noted throughout and like basically tracking what was going on. The plan was originally to study these effects and then move on into the treatment phase after 6 months to a year. However, once funding was cut, the treatment plan was deemed too expensive and never continued forward. They instead continued the study without informing the participants of the lack of funding for the next 40 years. Some were treated with alternative methods that were basically like the methods that they had over the time because syphilis, they still didn't have a cure for syphilis, which is why they were looking at how it affects the body going untreated. So some of the alternative methods were Salversan, or it was also known as 606, which, and also a lot of these treatments were harmful metal, like mercury and arsenic, like terrible things. But anyway, the 606 compound had side effects that included things like rash, liver damage, and what they described as the risk of life and limb. So that was one of the treatments for syphilis. Another alternative method was mercurial ointments, which again, yeah, just like it sounds, is mercury, which is those things that used to be in thermometers but aren't anymore because it can kill you. So these ointments often had such bad side effects that it was often confused as symptoms of the syphilis that it was designed to treat. And the last alternative method they used were things like bismuth, which isn't as toxic as other heavy metals like lead or arsenic, but can still lead to poisoning. So none of these alternative medicines actually did very much. They were probably more harmful than helpful. Many, instead of being given an alternative treatment, were just given a placebo to not affect the study results and just to kind of appease the med, like, here, we're giving you a treatment. Local doctors were even asked to assist with the study and not to treat the men who were participating. One local nurse, Eunice Rivers, was recruited to help be kind of like a middleman between the researchers and the participants. So she would drive the men to their appointments and even make sure that they didn't receive other treatments from local doctors.
Oh my God. And this went on for 40 years?
Mm-hmm. And she was one of the people that was actually there for most of it, but they don't have enough evidence to say whether she actually knew, because she was one of the, her and I think there was another doctor that were also a part of it, and both of them were African-American, because I believe they were both from the community, but it never said, like, they don't know to the extent of what they were told. So they might have just been like pawns in this as well, that they were told this was this great thing, you're going to be a part of this. And they weren't.
Because the cure for syphilis is penicillin, right?
1947. We're getting to that. Okay. That's my next point. because this started in 1932, remember?
Okay, yeah.
Well, the and cure penicillin, to syphilis.
Penicillin was like, Alexander Fleming was like 1920s. Was when it was found.
It wasn't wildly,
it wasn't
available
used.
Or even known as a cure. Yeah. So the cure to syphilis discovered in 1947 in the form of penicillin. Treatment centers popped up everywhere, and the U.S. government even backed these public health programs to try to eradicate the disease. When these programs came to Macon County, however, researchers blocked the participants from receiving the treatment. When 250 of the study participants registered for the draft during the war, which was around that same time, if not a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. When was World War II? Did that start? That was like 1941. World War II?
Yeah, 1941 to 1945.
Oh, okay. Then earlier than the cure for penicillin, they were, because I don't know, no one was super clear on the dates of this.
Okay.
And so they, researchers prevented them from getting treated despite military insistence that they be treated before they were serving. Because even the military was like, bro, you can't come here without syphilis. And the researchers were like, but you have to because don't take drugs for syphilis. So many of the men went blind, insane, and some even died from lack of treatment. When the study concluded in 1972, only 74 of the test subjects were still alive out of the 600 that they started with. Of the 399 who were infected with syphilis, 28 died directly from syphilis, is I guess what was listed as their cause of death.
Mm-hmm.
100 died of related complications. 40 of their wives had also been infected, and 19 of their children were born with congenital syphilis because it went untreated.
God. Well, and then probably out of those that died too, because you said that they weren't allowed to get autopsies except for by them, right? And like medically examined after they died.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably covered that shit up.
Yeah. So Austin V. Diebert and Albert P. Iskrant were just a few of the employees of the PHS who were not happy with the way the study was handled. They believed it was poor scientific practice and was just plain immoral.
Yes.
In addition to them, many more of the dissenters came out to express their concerns over the study. Among them was Erwin Schatz, a young doctor from Chicago who had apparently just become a doctor, and after reading an article about the study in a medical journal, wrote a letter to the authors telling them that it was brazen, unethical practice. But the letter was just filed away with a memo that no reply would be given and completely ignored.
Yeah, of course.
In 1966, Peter Buxton, a PHS venereal disease investigator from San Francisco, sent a letter to the nation director of the Division of Venereal Diseases stating that he had concerns over the ethics and morality of this extended study. The CDC was now in charge of the study, but still had held fast to the fact that the study needed to continue until completion, which basically meant until all the participants had died and been autopsied.
Okay.
I know. The CDC then got support from the National Medical Association, which is an organization that represents African American physicians, and the American Medical Association to kind of both like back their play. Basically, they're like, look, these guys are on board, so it's all good, which is such a shitty thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
More and more people began to speak out against the study and call for its end until Buxton finally went to the press in 1972. The Washington Star broke the story, and then it went like to the Associated Press, and then finally it was all over the front page of the New York Times. Pressure mounted on the CDC, so they created an advisory panel to review the study. It was found that while they agreed to certain terms of the study, they weren't informed on the study's actual purpose, and the data was all over the place. So remember how I told you that was their goal, was to find the differences. But then the way that they half treated and placebos, and they weren't using the control, and they never actually like did anything. Like, this study was all over the place. They were fudging data. It wasn't accurate. It was basically a pointless experiment over 40 years. So it was determined that the study was medically unjustified and it would cease immediately. The NAACP filed a class action lawsuit soon after, and the U.S. government paid $10 million, which in today's money would be $5.8 billion. So that's the equivalent.
Okay.
And agreed to provide free medical treatments to the surviving participants and the surviving family members. In 1974, Congress reacted by passing the National Research Act, which created, and this is, I'm saying a lot of things right now, so bear with me, the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research, to study and write the regulations that we have today governing these kinds of studies. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services even created the Office of Human Research Protections to oversee these types of clinical trials. Thanks to these offices and committees, we now have required informed consent on human studies and accurate reporting of test results, which is ridiculous that we didn't have that before.
Yeah.
Finally, in 1997, President Bill Clinton formally apologized for the incident and even held a ceremony at the White House for the surviving participants. 5 of the 8 survivors attended. They were, because that was all that was left in 1997. Yeah. They were Charlie Pollard, Herman Shaw, Carter Howard, Fred Simmons, and Frederick Moss. Family members for the other 3 men attended in their place. Sam Donner had his daughter Gwendolyn, Ernest Hendon had his brother North, and George Key had his grandson Christopher. The last of them passed away in 2004, and I believe it was in 2009 that the last beneficiary of that money, so the last child or wife, I think it was a spouse, last wife passed away. And so the unnecessary deaths of these men weren't the only consequences of this study, though. Once the study was revealed as pointless and inhumane, many African Americans still hold a deep mistrust in the medical community and of public health offices, which totally rings true today, because even if you look at the study, like, African American women are more likely to die during childbirth. Mm-hmm. Doctors are less likely to listen to them when they say they have like pain or things aren't feeling right. And it's just like so many things have come about because of this study in a negative light, like this mistrust. And then with everything going on today, like it kind of settled that, like that they have a right to mistrust the medical community. Absolutely. Like they're not being listened to. Because of studies like this that were done on race and things like that, that were totally bullshit, it came up with this narrative that like African-American people don't feel pain and African-American people can handle much more and they don't need this and they don't, and it's such bullshit. Like we're all people and we all feel pain and we all have suffering and these people need to be listened to. Like, anybody should be able to walk into a doctor's office and be like, something doesn't feel right, and be taken seriously.
Absolutely, yeah.
And as America being, like, what, a first world country, like, the fact that still in this day and age, minority women, especially African American women, still die while giving birth is ridiculous and should not be a thing.
Yeah.
But like, I know it was a little different of a crime, but what happened to these men and these wives and these children was straight up murder.
Oh, absolutely. Like, they
killed these people. They let them go and be infected without knowing it, let them spread disease when they didn't intend to. Like, it's just ridiculous. For nothing.
Yeah.
For absolutely nothing.
For very flawed science, where it doesn't seem like they even use scientific protocol, and like Norway did, like, okay, after the fact, they let these people that they knew had syphilis go untreated. Like, oh my God, that is so for fucking 40 terrible.
40 years.
So fucking terrible.
40 fucking years. That is such a long amount of time.
And to be no, we're doing this for your good, and it's this awesome treatment. Like, fuck you.
And ultimately, like, for it to even be, like, so discredited, and it was like, look, they did all of this stuff, and it still wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
And even, too, a lot of the articles I read, they brought up the connection between basically what happened in the Holocaust, how they were doing experiments and testing on the Jewish people.
Yeah, very and similar.
It was, that they were just doing these unethical studies. So the U.S. kind of modeled a lot of those, like, informed consent, because that's what happened in Germany. They started doing that. I believe it was, what, the Nuremberg trials or whatever they did. Okay. They started following that, kind of following suit, where they both got that, those policies in place. So, I mean, yes, it was terrible, and yes, all these things happen, but it's also really upsetting that we haven't really heard of this. Like, me or you hadn't heard of it. I even talked to another coworker who happened to see what I was working on. And she was like, what is that? And I was like, oh my God, you never heard of it either. Like, nobody I know knows of this study. So I just wanted to bring it to light.
Heck yeah.
Because that definitely something we should be talking about. And these men, even though they had to give their lives, they've led to, in some small way, helped other people by doing things like informed consent and making sure that studies are held accountable for what they do. So
yeah. No, that's good. Gosh.
All right. So that was my story.
All right. Thank you for sharing that. That's definitely something that needed to be talked about.
Now it's time for our super fun state facts
and cities.
All right. So I think you went first last time, so I have my fun fact.
Okay.
And it is about the Tuskegee Airmen, which we mentioned.
Oh, good.
Because basically any fun fact we look up is about them, and they're also pretty awesome because they, for anyone who doesn't know, they were like the first like African-American pilots, and they were pretty badass.
Yes.
So my fun fact about them is that the Tuskegee Airmen once shot down 3 German jets in a single day. On March 24th, 1944, a fleet of P-51 Mustangs led by Colonel Benjamin O. Davis, commander of the Tuskegee Airmen, set out on the longest escort mission their crews would fly during World War II. The 43 fighters were there to help B-17 bombers run a gauntlet of over 1,600 miles into the heart of Hitler's Germany and back. The bomber's target, a massive Daimler-Benz tank factory in Berlin, was heavily defended by whatever forces they could muster at this point. The 25 aircrafts protecting the plant included the battle-tested FW-190 radial propeller fighters, the ME-163 Comet rocket-powered plane, and the much more formidable ME-262, history's first jet fighter, and the forerunner of today's modern fighters, which I just said a lot of plane names that I don't know what they look like, but they sound pretty badass.
Yeah, they do. I also have no idea.
While the Americans' P-51s typically lagged behind the ME-163s and 262s, they could outmaneuver them at low speeds. The German planes also tended to run out of fuel more quickly than the Tuskegee Airmen's Mustangs. Making the most of their limited advantages, pilots Charles Brantley, Earl Lane, and Roscoe Brown all shot down German jets over Berlin that day, earning the all-black 332nd Fighter Group a Distinguished Unit Citation. So props to them.
Way to go, Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah. So what's your city fact?
Okay, so I mean, so my city is not super big, but so it's Phoenix City is where it took place. And now that is right across. So it's right on the like Georgia-Alabama border. Mm-hmm. And so to get to Georgia, so it's right across the river from Columbus, Georgia. So it's across the Chattahoochee River. So if anybody is a country fan, the first thing I hear of, think of, because I'd never heard of the Chattahoochee until the Alan Jackson song. So way down yonder on the Chattahoochee, it gets hotter than a hoochie coochie. So, which is kind of vulgar, which that came out like 93. I know. Dang, Alan Jackson. Anyway, so that's what goes through my head. But Phoenix City actually has some really interesting things happen to it. So one of the governors of Alabama, his name was Peterson, was from Phoenix City, and he actually was assassinated. But that's not the fact I'm giving you guys. I'm just telling you. Well, I guess it is a fact I'm giving you because I just told you. But that's not my fun fact for today. So Phoenix City, now it isn't spelled like Phoenix, like the bird, like you would think, or like Phoenix the city.
Mm-hmm. Like Arizona.
Yeah, like it is spelled like Phoenix the city because it's Phoenix City, but not Phoenix that we think of. Yes. So this Phoenix is spelled P-H-E-N-I-X. So it's missing a letter there. Now there is some rumor on why it is called that. So before the Civil War, Phoenix City was actually called Girard. So there was a mill across the Chattahoochee in Georgia. There was a mill there. And it actually ended up being burned down during the Civil War, as a lot of places in Georgia were. So after the Civil War, during the rebuilding of the South, the mill was rebuilt, and it was called, one of the mills was Eagle, and the other mill was called Phoenix. So the rumor is the guy did not know how to spell Phoenix. So he spelled it this incorrect way, depicting like the Phoenix bird because it was rising from the ashes. So this mill had been burned down and now it was built back even greater. And so it was the Phoenix Mill. Now, most of the employees that worked at the Phoenix Mill lived across the river in Alabama. And so the name, apparently, of the city changed from Girard to Phoenix City. Now, I don't know if this is actually a true story, but it is what the Chamber of Commerce says. So there's a historian. So you can go to Phoenix City, go to the Chamber of Commerce, And they have this pamphlet, and you can do a walking tour guide. And you can also listen to that guide. It's a YouTube video by this historian. So I listened to the YouTube video, not the whole thing. It was like 40 minutes long, and I didn't care that much about Phoenix City to listen to that. But the beginning of it is the story of how Phoenix City changed its name from Girard to Phoenix City. So that's how she said it happened. If you look at, like, Phoenix City has a Wikipedia page, and they said that that might not be true. But we're going to take it. So the owner of the mill was stupid and didn't know how to spell Phoenix. Spelled wrong. And nobody thought to change it.
Nice. I love it. All right. So something different we have for the state fact is me and Amber both found really funny state facts for Alabama. So I'm going to, let's see, who should share first? Me and then you, or sure. You and then me?
You can go.
Okay. Mom. I'll go ahead. So my fun fact for Alabama was that it's a Class B felony in Alabama to wrestle a bear. It is illegal to sell, purchase, possess, or train a bear for bear wrestling because apparently that was huge in Alabama, so much so that they had to add a law about bear exploitation that explicitly forbids people from engaging in bear wrestling matches. And a Class B felony has the same weight as like being charged with manslaughter. So that's how serious they take bear wrestling in Alabama. And I just needed to say that because, and Amber's is also a good fact. So I feel like Alabama deserved both of them.
Okay. So did you know that apparently it's illegal to purchase sex toys in Alabama unless you have a note from your doctor? Now, if this is true and still on the law book, or if it was ever really enforced, could you imagine what the reasoning for a doctor's note for a sex toy is? Like, I get the glaucoma, like, medical marijuana thing, but what the hell is the doctor putting for needing a sex toy?
Maybe it's a mental health thing, like you have attachment issues, or or maybe you have some type of dysfunction, so you need to,
yeah,
I don't know what type of medical issue would help with depression.
Helped by so it gives you some endorphins.
Oh my god. That's crazy.
So hopefully that's not the case, and like people who want to get sex toys, more power to you. Like whatever you do is your business. But damn, in Alabama, if you have to go to the doctor every time you want to go to, ours get is called Susie's. So in Fresno it's Susie's, but like, so whatever is the equivalent in Alabama towns to get their freak on. Dang, that's sad.
Oh, I know. Can you imagine being the store owner? Like, excuse me, I need to see your medical note so you can buy this. Or do they just sell sex toys at the pharmacy because...
I know!
Like, it's a prescription.
What the heck? Dude, if I lived in Alabama and I needed to get a sex toy, I would just order from, like, Adam and Eve.
Yeah, I wonder if that's still in force because you could just order from a website now. Like, you could get sex toys on, like, Amazon, on Adam and Eve.
All sorts of places. Like, you could take care of your business. Comes in discreet packaging, apparently.
According to the ads.
According to the ads, yeah. I mean, that's good, I guess. You don't want it, like, plastered on the front, like, right. Dildo.
Dude, tell me why, I know, or, like, a picture of the box. Tell me why we ordered, my husband got a new computer, like, a gaming computer, and so he got a new monitor with it. They straight up Amazon delivered. Luckily, I was home because I'm working from home, but they delivered the computer. It wasn't in another box. It was just in the monitor box. And I'm like, literally, like, there's a big ass picture of the monitor on the front. And I'm like, you're just going to leave this on my porch like this?
Yep.
What the fuck? Like, someone hell is going to steal that shit. So yeah, definitely don't want your sex toys showing up as is because you never know with Amazon, man. Like, I appreciate them saving the cardboard box, but Jesus Christ.
But please, if you're ordering Amazon, if somebody's ordering a sex toy, please put it in a cardboard box with the happy face. At least Amazon Prime. It fits.
Oh my god. All right, guys. So thank you so much for hanging out with us in Alabama this week. We had a lot of fun. We hope you did too. Hopefully we didn't get too loopy with you because we had to record so many episodes tonight. So, yeah, so make sure you like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast. If you have a correction, a fun state fact, a case you want us to look into for those states we're coming up on, please email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. Also, still trucking along with our election and census shout outs. So if you are registered to vote or have voted already, I know some primaries are happening right now in different states. So if you voted in your primary, let us know. If you plan on voting in the general election, let us know. Make sure you're registered to vote. Let us know. We'll give you a shout out in the beginning of the episode. Same thing with the census. If you fill that out, it takes less than 5 minutes. So you all better have done it, whether you tell us or not. But if you do tell us, we'll shout you out in the episode as well. So make sure you let us know. Also, make sure to leave us a review on Facebook or Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find us and like our page and get to know us. Next week, we're moving up. I think we're in Tennessee.
Tennessee.
Yeah. It'll be in Tennessee. Isn't that where, no, is that where Graceland's at? Tennessee's country music, right?
Yeah,
Nashville, that? All right, cool. So we're heading up there. I'm sure Amber will have a lot of songs to sing for us. She's a big country girl, not me. Nope, nope.
Country and Elvis. Man,
oh my goodness. It's a lot of that.
I'll try.
So we'll see you guys next week in Tennessee. All right,
bye. Bye.